Hi everyone, I'm Kasia Fali. I'm a GP in Glasgow and the primary care lead for the Diabetes Clinical Network for Glasgow and Clyde. I'm really pleased to have with me today Dr. Sarah Davies, who is going to chat to me about the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, the real concern of many patients presenting later, but also the fact that there are many underdiagnosed patients out there and patients being diagnosed at a much younger age group. Hi Sarah, how are you?
Hi, Cash. Great to be here. I'm good, thank you. My name's Sarah Davies. I am, as you said, a GP with a special interest in diabetes from Cardiff and the primary care lead for diabetes for Wales. So great to be here, Cash. Some really interesting things to talk about today, I think.
Great. Yes, no, absolutely. And I think this really stems from a report from the UK Office for National Statistics that estimate that 30%, approximately 1 million of the adults living with type 2 diabetes in England between 2013 and 2019, so this is pre-pandemic, were undiagnosed. And they also indicate that 7 to 10% of adults in England had type 2 diabetes. Up to 1 in 9 adults, that's almost 5.1 million people, had pre-diabetes. So this is a really interesting finding, and it's a shockingly high number of patients that are unaware of their condition. What are your thoughts, Sarah? I'm sure you've seen in your own practice many patients presenting later, and also many patients presenting at a younger age. But what about those figures? Do they surprise you?
Not really, unfortunately, but I was fascinated to read it. So this is, it comes from a health survey for England that they do a sort of snapshot cross-sectional survey, and they do it annually. What happens is the patients are sent a questionnaire, which they then complete, and then there's a nurse visit where they have bloods taken and what have you. And they looked at, as you said, data between 2013 and 2019, 26,500 people involved in this. So quite a significant number. So we can be fairly certain this is pretty representative of the population in which we're working. And as you said, you know, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes ranged between 7 and 10%. And that's not unexpected. We're definitely seeing that. Those are the sort of numbers certainly I'm seeing here in Wales. It does vary. Particularly in terms of areas of deprivation. So higher level of deprivation, higher levels of type 2 diabetes. It also varies in terms of ethnicity. So we see higher levels of type 2 diabetes in people of South Asian background, for example, African Caribbean and so on. So we see variability, but what we do see, Cash, is a rise. We see this steady increase in the prevalence of type 2 diabetes. You know, I look at the Welsh data frequently in my lead role for Wales of, you know, for primary care diabetes, and you just see this steady increase all the time. You know, it was only about, gosh, a few months ago that I saw the numbers in Wales go over 200,000 for diagnosed type 2 diabetes, and now we're already up to, I think, 208,000 just a few months later. And I just sort of see this steady increase, and we're seeing that, as I say, across England and Scotland as well, with those higher rates in areas of high deprivation and high levels of people with higher risk ethnic background as well. I think the most shocking part of this data was, as you've said already, those people who didn't know they had type 2 diabetes. Up to 30% did not know they had type 2 diabetes until they underwent this snapshot survey and had their bloods taken. So those are terrifying numbers in terms of people that might be wandering around with no idea that they've got type 2.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. And do you think that we have a role here for more education on the symptoms and signs of diabetes? But as we both know, that in many cases, there are no symptoms to begin with. And then that then goes to another, you know, wider point about health screening and population level screening. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Big questions. You know, I think we all have a role in that educational piece, particularly people at risk of type 2 diabetes. So thinking about people who are living with overweight or obesity, have a family history of type 2 diabetes, have other cardiovascular risk factors, hypertension, for example. These are all people where we should be considering that as a possibility and absolutely educating for people to look for those symptoms. So you're right, a lot of people particularly in the early stages, will not have symptoms. But people can start to think about, you know, those osmotic symptoms, for example, recurrent thrush or balanitis can be symbolic of type 2 diabetes. But actually, we really want to spot those people who've got an HbA1c in what, the sort of low 50s, just as they tip into type 2 diabetes, because that's when we can really make a difference to act early and even think about remission or at least great control of their type 2 diabetes for a number of years after diagnosis. So I think there's an educational role for people getting checked, especially people who are at risk. So whether that comes from us in primary care, from the government, from our third sector partners. So Diabetes UK, for example, a brilliant charity, as we know, loads of great online information. And they're really good at these kind of public health type strategies around education, looking for symptoms and so on and getting yourself checked. The screening issue is an interesting one, isn't it? And screening is always controversial as to whether screening is the way forward and at a population level. Of course, what we do in primary care is we identify the at risk, and hopefully we're doing those annual bloods. So someone with hypertension will probably be having an annual A1C done under our care so that we can check. Or someone, for example, with prediabetes or non-diabetic hyperglycemia, again, we'll be having that annual A1C. Gestational diabetes, again, another group where people should be having an annual A1C for life to try and spot that type 2 at an early stage. But what about all those people that are not on those annual reviews? Those kind of the unseen, the unknown unknowns, very difficult. And I'm not sure, those numbers are scary, but I'm not sure of the answer in terms of how we reach those groups and get those people diagnosed. It's very challenging.
Absolutely, a real challenge. And it does need a system-wide approach. Another really important finding, which again may not surprise us, but younger adults with type 2 diabetes were more likely to be undiagnosed than older adults. In fact, 50% of those aged between 16 and 44. Now, that's a really staggering figure, but what are your views about younger adults and type 2 diabetes, not only about awareness, but also the treatment pathways that are available to them?
Yeah, this is a really important hot topic in the world of type 2 diabetes at the moment. So we know that the incidence of type 2 diabetes is rising. You're more likely to have type 2 diabetes if you're older. However, proportionally, the number of people being diagnosed under the age of 40 is increasing more rapidly than those over the age of 40. Interesting statistic, there's more people now in England under the age of 40 with type 2 diabetes than type 1 diabetes. And I'm sure we're all seeing that in our own practice. I've certainly seen people being diagnosed in their 30s and 20s in my practice. And some people, I'm sure, are seeing people even below that. So this group is at high risk. They're at high risk of developing type 2 diabetes if they have other risk factors particularly. And we're seeing rising levels of overweight and obesity in these groups. And it's often associated with that. But also, we know that earlier onset type 2 diabetes, so developing type 2 diabetes under the age of 40, is associated with significantly worse outcomes. So it seems to have almost a more aggressive course in terms of the way that type 2 diabetes progresses in those younger adults. So higher rates of complications after a shorter period of time, poor pregnancy outcomes in these groups, less likely to achieve treatment targets, less likely to get care processes completed. It is not a good diagnosis in younger people. And especially if people are not getting spotted early, that is a big concern in this group. And we definitely need to think about our approach to the management of younger people with type 2 diabetes.
Absolutely. These are really scary sort of facts. And the fact that these patients that go, you know, certainly may not even be aware of their diagnosis, but at higher risk, it really is important to get that diagnosis right. But I think one of the other findings generally has been there's also an increased risk of women, especially younger women, being undiagnosed, unaware of the conditions. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, it's a worry. So often we're seeing that in particularly young women living with significant overweight or obesity. And, you know, we're seeing high levels in that group. And the concern with that is, of course, as we've already said, that rapid onset of complications and so on, but also concerned around pregnancy outcomes. So we know, you know, poorly controlled type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes in pregnancy is associated with poor outcomes for both baby and for mum. And that's a big worry. We're also, of course, restricted in terms of the medications we can use to manage somebody who is perhaps trying to conceive. And I think it's important that we identify that issue in that group. So if you do see somebody who has got type 2 diabetes, who is of fertile age, really important to think about things like pre-pregnancy counselling, involving specialist teams at an early stage if necessary, and about the medications that we're using, which, you know, may not be appropriate if someone's planning a pregnancy.
Yeah, really important points. And that reminds me of a case that my own practice was involved in, which has turned into a significant event. A 34-year-old woman who was diagnosed with diabetes, I think, during the pandemic. Now, she presented with very vague symptoms. I think it was just pins and needles in her hands. She was sent for some bloods, and the bloods, I think, initially showed a raised random glucose. But then when she returned for an HbA1c, this was very high at 76 at diagnosis. Now, during the pandemic, access, as we know, to in-person consultations was difficult. However, she was informed of her diagnosis, but was not preconception counselling or fertility was not discussed. She was actually pregnant very soon after her diagnosis. And unfortunately, she went on to have a miscarriage in her second trimester. And that just illustrates the importance of not only early diagnosis in women, but also the importance of preconception counselling, getting these patients onto contraception very early, and also referring them onto specialist diabetes services if they're contemplating pregnancy. I mean, has that been your finding as well, that maybe we're not as good and we're not as mindful that these women may still be wanting to get pregnant?
Yeah, oh, it sends shivers down my spine, that case, Cash. You know, it's a really a really good reminder for us, I think. Yeah, absolutely. We're perhaps not used to managing people living with type 2 diabetes, you know, of women in their 20s, 30s, or indeed 40s as well. And it's vital that we have that conversation. So it should be part of our annual diabetes review at the very least. You know, are you planning a pregnancy? You know, that we should absolutely be very mindful of this. And in most areas now, there will be access to preconception counselling or preconception specialist teams. Certainly here in Wales, we've got diabetes specialist nurse team that run that side of things for us. And so, yeah, really important to get women that support, preferably well before they even conceive that pregnancy, because that's what's going to improve the outcomes for mum and baby.
Absolutely. And you also mentioned the medications. Now, we know with guidelines that SGLT2 inhibitors are second line for most of our patients with type 2 diabetes, and also GLP-1s. Now, what are your thoughts about that in younger sort of female patients that are overweight, that may want to benefit from these medications, but obviously have this significant risk with pregnancy?
I think we have to have a very open and frank, honest conversation with that person about that. So we shouldn't be using these medications in people who are actively trying to conceive. However, as you say, they're going to gain significantly from them in terms of glycemic control and weight reduction as well. So I would normally talk about getting good control, first of all, perhaps making sure that lady's on great contraception, coil implant, what have you, and then getting the glycemic control, helping them to bring their weight down, because also that's going to improve pregnancy outcomes as well. And then talk about planning that pregnancy in a really kind of planned out way, if you like, where we can make sure those medications are stopped, they've got input of specialist teams, and then we control diabetes in ways that are safe during pregnancy, be that with insulin if required.
Going back to this survey, we also found that people from Black and Asian ethnic groups had more than double the prevalence of prediabetes and undiagnosed type 2 diabetes. So this is a real challenge, and these are groups that may not access healthcare as well as the wider population. I mean, what are your thoughts, Sarah, on how we can approach this group, and what are the increased risks that they face?
Yeah, you know, we have to bear in mind, you know, who is at greatest risk here. We've talked about, you know, younger people, but people of Black and Asian ethnic groups are at significantly higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes in the first place. But as you said, this survey shows that there's huge amount. So I think it was double the prevalence of pre-diabetes and undiagnosed type 2 as well in these groups. So how can we reach these groups? You know, should we be seeking out our patients that are under our care, who are at risk, who have never had an HbA1c or nothing in recent times, perhaps? How can we find ways to get into the community and to use community leaders to try and access groups? We talk about the language that we use, and sometimes actually if someone is not able to speak good English, they can't read in English perhaps, it's important that we're mindful of these issues as well. One of the most rewarding things I ever did in my local area was I went and attended a mosque, and it was a diabetes awareness day, and it was ladies only. So it was just ladies and girls that came to this mosque. And I just did a very simple talk about awareness of type 2 diabetes, symptoms to look for, increased risk in certain ethnic groups and so on. And it was so rewarding. I couldn't get out of there, Cash, because these ladies were coming up to me in the corridor as I was leaving, wanting to talk more, to learn more. And I think it was a good example of getting into the community. And it was a community leader that initiated that session. And so I think thinking outside of the box, you know, not perhaps the normal way that we would call and recall people, but to think about different ways to access our harder to reach groups is very important.
I mean, that's a great story, and it's great to hear about the work that you're doing, and I'm sure a lot of our colleagues are doing in outreach to these communities. I mean, we've illustrated the increased risks to the younger population, and you've already mentioned that maybe pathways there are not as developed or adapted to their needs. I mean, what do you think would be the key factors that we now need to use in planning services for younger patients? And a follow-up on that is, how do we approach that consultation? How do we communicate the increased risks to this younger population?
Yeah, I think we just need to think about working a bit differently with this group. You know, these are young people. They're often working long days. They do not want to come into the surgery at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning to have their annual diabetes review. And as such, we are seeing, you know, poorer completion of care processes, achievement of treatment targets in this group. So I think we need to consider how we're working, how we're inviting these people, whether we're using digital communication in the best way with these groups. I think there's a good opportunity for that. I think, you know, we just need to be very mindful of the increased risk that these people face. And I know in NHS England, there's a lot of work been going on. There's increased enhanced funding called the T2Day programme in NHS England, which is giving ICSs additional funding for those enhanced reviews, thinking of different ways of working for our younger people with a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. So being mindful of the increased risk ourselves is important, and thinking about how we're going to support that person.
It's so important to be aware of the behavioural and psychosocial characteristics of this population as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very different approach perhaps to somebody who's in their 60s or 70s with type 2 diabetes. We need to just think differently about how we're doing things. And in terms of how we have the conversation, it's really, I think, one of the reasons that younger people with a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes may not come back to see us and may not want to engage with treatment is because they feel completely fine. And actually, when you're 25, thinking about, oh, I might have a heart attack when I'm 55, feels like forever away. So again, the way that we describe risk, the way that we talk about, you know, the importance of control of type 2 diabetes, the importance of that risk management, I think we have to tailor that to the person sat in front of us again and take that holistic approach to having those conversations. But it's not easy.
Absolutely. And I think you're quite right that tailored and the holistic approach is really needed. And communicating risk is something that we do effectively as best as we can in primary care, but it is a very difficult conversation. And I think hopefully at government level and health board levels, there's going to be increased work in targeting these younger and at-risk groups. Just as we come to the end of this, Sarah, many of our colleagues will be quite alarmed by the number of underdiagnosed. And in terms of the risk groups that we really now need to be mindful that they should be going for a glucose or HbA1c check, what sort of risk factors or which groups would you advocate that we should be actively seeking a diagnosis of pre-diabetes or diabetes?
So I'd be thinking about people of at-risk ethnic backgrounds, so South Asians, Afro-Caribbeans and so on. I'd be thinking about people with known overweight and obesity, definitely. So look at your patients with a high BMI. Have they had a regular A1C? Women with a history of gestational diabetes is important, and people with other cardiovascular risk factors. So hypertension, heart failure, existing cardiovascular disease, and kidney disease as well. These patients are all at high risk, and you know, we should, I think, be actively looking for type 2 diabetes on a regular basis in those groups.
Absolutely, I agree with all of that. And one other group that I think we would both agree on is those with severe enduring mental illness and those with learning difficulties and disabilities that may not be accessing healthcare and are at increased risk of obesity and being overweight due to their treatments. So that's another group that we sometimes are neglectful of, especially when it comes to diabetes and cardiovascular screening.
Absolutely. The data on the outcome for people living with severe mental illness with type 2 diabetes is really shockingly poor. You know, many years of life lost. So you're absolutely right, Cash. You know, actively looking for pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes in those groups. So severe mental illness, learning disabilities, very, very important as well. You're quite right.
Great. I think that's been a really useful discussion, Sarah. So, I mean, really, the take-home points are that there are many patients out there that are unaware of their diagnosis and that are underdiagnosed. So it's really being mindful of signposting patients to ensure that they are getting those checks done and being able to access the appropriate services. Is there any one other take-home point that you would want to share with our listeners?
I suppose it's just about great glycemic control from the start. You know, so we know, and they've got great data now, you know, really long-term data, that if we can get 10 years of great glycemic control in people after a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, we can significantly improve outcomes, as well as using, of course, early cardioprotective therapies in these groups as well. So we need to be proactive, look for type 2 diabetes, find it, and then do our best to support that person to control it as well as possible.
That's excellent. And I totally agree. That's been a really helpful discussion. A lot of food for thought and a lot of challenging work ahead. So thank you again, Sarah, for your time.
Thanks, Cash. Great to chat. See you soon.
Take care.